We are entering a new age, an age demanding greater collaboration, enhanced creativity, heightened agility. Welcome to Agile and Beyond, a podcast for agile enthusiasts, design thinkers, team builders, and organization designers. With practitioners and thinkers, we explore the future of work, the evolutions in leadership mindset, and the revolutions in the human-centered innovation around experience and purpose. In episode 2 of a 3-part conversation with Chuck Durfee, Agile Coach, Development Manager, Agile Denver Board Member Emeritus, recent MBA graduate, recovering developer, and friend of Neon Tapirs Everywhere, we enjoyed a far-ranging conversation. We discussed the following: the spreading of ideas, developmentally driven organizations, people innovation, the agile mindset, Montessori education, language learning, design patterns, Conway's Law, organization designs, the scarcity mindset, the limits of the industrial model, exploratory play, and how structure relates to creativity. And now, welcome to the second episode of a 3-part conversation with Chuck Durfee. So back to the idea of spreading an idea.
Yeah.
When you're trying to explore what can be done, is a lot of it listening, figuring out what motivates somebody, what someone's intentions are, actively listening to that, and then trying to serve them, trying to help them do what they want to do. That's a
very good strategy for me. I've been at work many times. That's not the only tool that I have in my toolbox, but yeah, that's an important one.
Okay. And what does that particular tool often provide to the situation? What's some of the fallout?
Intrinsic motivation. That's what it provides. If you can get somebody interested in doing something because it furthers one of their own goals, they're going to be internally motivated in order to develop and deliver that particular idea. Right now, I think I'm reading an Everyone Culture, and it's all talking about developmentally driven organizations where the focus is on developing people instead of developing products.
Interesting. Yeah, this comes down to this whole the quote technology of the future is actually, or the innovation of the future is not technical innovation. It's sort of people innovation. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would argue that with knowledge workers, the value is the people.
And would that be your argument?
Well, it's certainly been my experience.
Interesting. So you develop this intrinsic motivation. How does trust come into play, if at all, in this technique or other techniques?
Yeah. So trust is vital. It's vital for any Scrum team, as you probably well know. But if you do not have the trust of the people who you're interacting with, communication begins to break down because knowledge begins to be withheld. And that causes all sorts of degenerative behavior. You'll find people who are not only hoarding knowledge, which is the primary resource of a knowledge worker, but they'll start hoarding other resources as well. And they could begin to start working at cross purposes. So you end up with misalignment and other problems. So I try to avoid that by aligning with the people that I'm working with as much as I can.
And how do you do that?
Well, that's you hit it on the head. Active listening is really key, and then finding commonalities or differences and exploring them. I've learned a lot from people who had different interests than my own.
So sort of withholding a judgment in the exploration of the difference?
Yes, withholding judgment. That's an excellent way to put it. I don't have a – I haven't written out this entire methodology. This is an interesting exploration for me because I'm putting some words to ideas that have been in my head for a while.
No, it's interesting. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I'm hearing things that you're saying between your stories to me are indicating a certain approach that you're taking and certain techniques that you're employing that you're kind of just talking over in an interesting way. It seems that I guess my impression is that this mindset that you really have internalized this agile mindset or you were raised at some level.
I was going to say, let's talk about that a little bit.
Please.
Because I have a non-traditional background of growing up. My first schooling experience was in a Maria Montessori school, and I did that for a number of years. And that is extremely compatible with Agile in a lot of ways because Maria Montessori is all about learning through explorative play.
Okay. Let's go into this. So I guess we have some admirers here outside of the studio.
This
so
is exactly the way that cubicle experience was. People were looking in to see what wonderful things we were doing.
It's a shame they can't hear us.
I know.
We'd get more.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it, to have the whole library talking?
It would. This reminds me of a I know this is kind of a tangent because I do want to come back to the Montessori thing, but please. You just reminded me of the sort of this mob or the spread of a virus or the spread of a meme. And somebody had posted on LinkedIn a couple of days ago and a video. And at the top of the video, it said, like, this is a great example of leadership. And in the video was a picture of a guy dancing on a hill. It was called Guy Dancing on a Hill at the Sasquatch 2009 Music Festival or something.
I think
like
I've
that.
Seen this video, and other people started dancing as well.
Unbelievable. And this guy had this unique, sort of quirky, dorky, but really cool style of dancing that he was dancing. He was totally into the music on this hill, and somebody was filming him, and then one other guy joins him, and then obviously this attracts some attention, and then within 20 seconds or 30 seconds, the hill was filled with people dancing. So
it's very similar, yeah. I guess I'm the Sasquatch guy dancing on the hill.
You're the guy
dancing
on the hill.
That's my new tagline, I think.
Yeah, Sasquatch. Sasquatch, that's your new nickname,
maybe
Sasquatch.
So. Let's do it.
So the Montessori education.
Sure.
I've been very fascinated with this. I was not educated in that way, but I do recall I was living in southern New Hampshire at the time, and there was a Montessori school within 30 minutes, an hour of where I lived. And I often would go to talks that were given, either music festivals or interesting speakers that would come and speak at these schools. And I just found the atmosphere and the guests that were there just fascinating, and the environment, the energy of this exploratory nature. So I please dig into this. I'd love to hear the resonance between that education and the agile mindset.
Sure. Well, I can talk to it as an elementary school kind of age student, but I didn't have anything to compare it to, of course, but having talked to a lot of other people, it was very unstructured in comparison. And that's one of that's the strength and weakness of Montessori education, in my opinion. For somebody who is a self-directed learner, it can be fantastic. I was able to accelerate through quite a few areas of curriculum and go very deep. Geography at that was a particularly interesting subject to me at the time. But the downside is if you don't have somebody who's prodding you and encouraging you in areas that may not be, say, your favorite area, those areas can stagnate. So I ended up being quite a lopsided child education-wise by the end of this experience.
Interesting. So which areas would you say hyper-developed? Of course, I don't mean to put words into your mouth.
No, that's quite all right. Math certainly was a strong subject for me. science along those lines. English was not. So if we fast forward a little bit, I went to more of a British primary school style educational facility after that. That was more my middle school years.
So like in, 12, 13, 14 or something of that?
Yeah, it was about that age. Yeah, maybe a little earlier.
Okay.
And I was doing pre-calculus work at that time.
Wow.
But I didn't – nobody had taught me phonetics. So I had to go back and relearn how to spell because I had just memorized how to spell thousands of words. And it only came up in passing that I didn't know a lot of this foundational language arts material.
Oh, interesting. So you must have been a really good speller. I mean, like a sort of visual, very strong.
To me, they were just symbols being put in an order, and that was something I was really good at.
Interesting.
Probably still am, but.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. Interesting. So that this following the path, from my understanding, this is is it related to Wilhelm von Humboldt's view of the enlightened education sort of instead of giving the student a prescriptive curriculum that prepares them for an industrial economy, it's sort of this original enlightenment idea where the student is given the freedom to follow whatever path or the line or the thread that they're interested in.
That certainly describes Montessori. I'm not familiar with von Humboldt, but...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
That relates pretty well to Agile, to circle the conversation back a little bit, but we can talk all day about this kind of stuff. But it fits really well with Agile because in Agile, you're often presented with a problem space that's somewhat unfamiliar, and you need to do some exploratory or product discovery kind of work to figure out what approach you want to take in order to achieve whatever goal you're trying to get in the end.
Now, interesting. Now, the Montessori education was mainly an individual exploring something on their own while – oh, small groups as well.
I formed some really good friendships there because I was – we self-selected groups and we found groups that we were really compatible with.
Can I
talk a little bit about
that?
Yeah,
the one that comes most to mind, you.
Well, from the age of about 6 or so until 17, my best friend was a gentleman named William, and he and I had not identical but very compatible ways of looking at the world. And so we would go off and do projects together. And there were other people who were involved in that group, but the two of us would almost always work together.
And so what kind of projects interested you?
What kind of stuff would you do? So an example of Montessori learning might be we had these little teaching cubes that were called centicubes. They were all 1-centimeter cubes, and they had little – not dissimilar to Legos. They had bumps and they had sockets that you could fit these things together in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had decided that we were going to build a city. So we started building a city. And then a teacher named Gary, he was responsible for more of the STEM sort of education, came by and asked us questions like, what do they do with their trash? And started getting us thinking about city planning and sanitation and started branching us off into those kinds of directions. And he would ask, you know, what would that be made of? Is that, you know, is that made of metal? Is that made of plastic? And, you know, what are some of the trade-offs that you would have? And so we get into those kinds of in-depth conversations.
Interesting. And would this require real life tests, or would you go to a computer, or would you go to a library to look things up?
Too early for computers, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of library research going on. Sometimes there would be physical science experiments, but that was pretty rare. The Montessori school that, at that time it had become a New Age Institute, which was an odd name now that I'm an adult, but as a kid it was fine. But they were somewhat strapped for resources. So things like hands-on science experiments were not something that happened as frequently. Good okay. staff, though.
And so when Gary came, the teacher Gary came along mm-hmm. and asked you some of these questions,
sure.
where did the discussion that you and William were having about the building of this city, where were your natural inclinations in the response of this, or how did that resonate with you when he asked you that?
I would say that I was more on the left brain side of things and figuring things out from a more analytical point of view, whereas William was more of a creative artist mm-hmm. Who was coming up with interesting narratives about things. We were both really into science fiction, so they always involve some sort of extra normal, you know, whether it was an alien city that we were working on or whatnot. But right. I ate it up, so
that's
it worked out really well.
That's very cool. Now I see that you've dabbled or you speak a bit of German.
How did that? Ich spreche Deutsch. Yeah.
Sprichst du Deutsch? Huh.
Yeah. I yeah. do.
And where did you pick that up?
Well, this is all the same thing, right? Just a different application of the same idea. So, the Maria Montessori School was bilingual. So in the morning we did all of our schoolwork in English, and in the afternoons we did all our schoolwork in Spanish.
Wow.
We quickly learned how to say, something like, how do you say Tommy is a butthead in Spanish? And so we would hack whatever we wanted to communicate, things that we didn't know how to say. We would just go near a teacher and employ some translation sentences. It was kind of funny, actually. But it worked out really well. I can't speak Spanish very well these days, but if I go to some place like the Caribbean, why, I can understand quite a bit of what's being said.
You can call the guy across the bar a butthead,
well,
for example.
Maybe, yeah. No, we did. They never really help us with those kind of words, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, it's been 35 years maybe since I had exposure to Spanish in that way, and I still remember quite a bit. And that's when if I were to summarize the key learning from Montessori, it is to take a piece of knowledge and make it your own. Figure out a way to integrate it into your worldview or something about something that you're passionate about. So, for example, if you're interested in learning statistics and you love basketball, start studying basketball statistics and make it real for you.
Right.
So learn Spanish. Then little middle school French, and then went into German. And I did German in high school for 3 years, developed a pen pal, continued to correspond with that pen pal for about a decade afterward.
Wow.
And have been keeping that knowledge somewhat fresh ever since. I'm somewhere at an A2 B1 level in German.
That's great.
Using the international scale.
Right. I actually studied in I took a 3 month hiatus from my time when I was in China, and I decided to study French, and I also decided to study German. I studied at a Goethe Institute China, and I studied at Alliance Française in China.
Yeah.
And then I decided to head over to a school in Berlin and study German intensively for 3 months. So that was a great experience.
I'm sure I would really enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm sure you would.
Yeah.
We had some class. I remember we would have little seminars at the end of the formal classes where somebody would get up in German and talk about the history of the Nazis or something, or somebody would talk about the history of Berlin from its origin till modern days, and you're listening to the whole thing in intermediate level German, and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm understanding some of it, but not all of it.
And
was
that's
fascinating.
Really all that's important at that stage, and hearing some of those words and just being stretched a little bit beyond where you are today really inspires you to start learning some of this vocabulary, and it just grows.
Exactly.
That's the same kind of process that I use to foster agile discovery. I really love lean experiments for that very reason. Let's try an idea and tweak it or throw it away. Or incorporate it, one of the three.
And then it sounds like, well, there's a motivation aspect
there. Is,
so it's almost like a triangulation. You have to find out on your team, or how does that work?
If we're applying it on a team, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
If I've got a developer right now who is not very interested in the business problem that we're trying to solve at all, but he is interested in learning the technical aspects of the job. Trying to motivate him to be interested in things like backlog refinement can be interesting at times, right? Because he just wants to focus on whatever the technical problem is. And, oh, I can solve that with this algorithm. And then he's disengaged.
That's interesting. Right?
So trying to find ways to get him interested in, let me put that differently, trying to frame some of these problems in a way that would entice him can be interesting sometimes.
What are some techniques that you've attempted?
Well, one of the talks that I did at Mile High Agile 2013 was Design Patterns in Non-Software Contexts. And that's a really rich and interesting field in itself. So let's take an object pool, for example. It's not a gang of four pattern, but it's a pretty common pattern. Mm-hmm. It's used for things like connecting to a SQL server. You have a set of connections that you use. That's a connection mm-hmm. pool. That's mm-hmm. an example of an object pool.
Okay.
But it also turns out that if you go to the bowling alley, they obviously don't have enough bowling balls for everybody to have their own bowling ball. So they have this pool of bowling balls that people borrow.
Okay.
And you can directly map each piece of the formal definition of an object pool to some mechanism that happens in a bowling alley. So if you happen to be a bowling aficionado, that gives you a touchstone into this object pool. For this developer
into
that I was
this,
talking
into
about.
This design pattern
Sorry, yes,
methodology.
The design pool, my fault.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is essentially the reverse of that, right? Where I'm taking these business problems and trying to express them in more technical terms. If you're not interested in agile process, you might be interested in refactoring that process. I mean, you go through refactoring code all the time, right? That's an iterative process where you're refining and improving the quality of the code in various ways. Well, that's really all we're doing when we're doing things like retrospectives, is that we're taking our agile process and taking pieces of it and trying to refine them and move it more into a better working whole.
Interesting. So you allow the developer to sort of conceptualize the role of a product owner, of the organization, of the customer as almost entities within some kind of a model that he or she can work with and think of how can I satisfy that particular object, let's say, that's in the real world, and he can sort of algorize. Is that a word?
It is now.
the real world space. I don't know.
No, you're absolutely right. Normally, it doesn't happen in such a large. Let me take all of these worldviews and suddenly I take a look at everything. Normally, these examples happen really small, but you're absolutely right. You could apply this idea over and over again and help them develop an interest in these other aspects of what's going on.
Interesting. You're a bridge person.
Yes
or no?
I do tend to perform that role, yeah.
Interesting.
I'm really comfortable there.
Interesting. Now you've explained how you do it one way. How does it have you played the role in the opposite
the other way
to
sure.
help the business person understand what's happening technically?
Sure. So we gave that example earlier of the business analyst at TSYS who we taught to code.
Mm, right.
They began to have some appreciation for the product, you know, the development pipeline that we had created and what we were trying to accomplish and why releases have to go through this QA cycle the way that we were handling it at the time. Because suddenly it was their code that was going through this stuff. I was able to make it personal for her.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let's take a like a slight turn.
Yeah, feel free.
In the conversation. We talked some about Agile Denver
sure.
and its evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So you said in the early days it was more developer focused or more team focused. And as time, the membership has become more management focused. And
that's very true. So when Alex Vecchio created XP Denver at the time, and I think it was 1990.
Oh, that was the original name.
Yes. Uh-huh. It was clearly very focused on extreme programming. Nowadays, if you take a look at the roster of people who are signed up for a conference like Mile High Agile 2016, very predominantly product managers. So there's definitely been a shift in the membership of Agile Denver from a more technical to a less technical audience.
And so where did the technical people go? Did they get split up into different technical domains? You know, they wanted to learn a particular operating system or particular technology or programming language, or what happened to them?
That's a great question, Dan. I would love to know the answer to that, but I've of course got a couple theories for you.
Well, I'd love to hear the theories. Let's diverge here.
Yeah, exactly. So some of that has to do with the profusion of different operating systems and languages and methodologies and frameworks that we're expecting our developers to now have command over. We've gone to single-page applications that now handle both front and back end. That adds a lot of stress. We're asking developers to be cognizant of relational databases like, say, SQL Server, Oracle, those kinds of things, but we also want them to have some experience with NoSQL databases. We want them to understand the advantages and disadvantages of Mongo and Cassandra and all that stuff. We went from a culture where we're developing this central server architecture of an application, and now we're a lot more interested in distributed computing. So now they need to not only understand multi-threading, concurrency concerns, all those technical challenges that you might have, but they also need to understand things like infrastructure or platform as a service and understand how to configure and handle something like an Amazon or web services or Heroku world. If you put all of that stuff together, developers don't spend as much time thinking about the way that they're relating to their other team members. They're just trying to keep up with this flow of information that's happening. Some developers specialize, but a lot of them end up being jack of all trades.
Yeah, and as a former software developer myself,
before, I'm recovering as well.
I'm recovering. Yes, it's for me personally. It's a tough thing to do. I mean, just to stay current with your skill set and to keep up with the demands of the shifting technology. You had to use your free time, from my understanding, mm-hmm. constantly take learning new languages. I mean, it makes learning human languages a piece of cake in relation, my experience.
Very true. That's one of the reasons that I dabble in spoken languages, because it's a lot easier to talk to a human being who will help interpolate what you're trying to say as opposed to a computer that'll just throw a compiler. You're absolutely right.
Unless you say that with perfect pitch and perfect syntax. Grammar, perfect
yeah,
syntax,
exactly.
Then I'm not going to understand
that's right.
anything you said. Yeah. Yeah.
Nor will I help you understand why I can't figure it out.
Right.
I'm just going to say error.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. This gets back to that developmental organization idea, the DDO, right? If you want to invest in your people, then it's clear that they don't have to spend their free time keeping up with current technology because that becomes part of their goal. We want to develop a competitive advantage in the space. You need to learn the latest technologies in order to help us do that. Kind of turns the problem on its head a little
bit. So you're saying the organization will invest in the training for its team in this paradigm?
In that style of organization, they would, right? So if you really believe that knowledge workers are your asset, then you want to develop that asset. And that involves two things. One, you want to grow their capabilities, but you also, being humans, you want to continue to motivate them to want to be a part of your organization. Otherwise, you train them and they leave, right?
Well, that was my follow-up question. And this comes from, is this related to a scarcity or a lack mentality, if you understand my question?
I do. Absolutely it is. At least it's been my experience that in areas where you find a lot of siloing, you also find that scarcity mentality.
And this is something, where would this mentality be located in this scenario that we're talking about? Who would have this mentality?
I see it. Well, we're starting to talk a little bit about Conway's law in a sense, right?
Well, I don't know. Please educate me.
Sure.
On that.
So Conway's law basically says that the architecture of your organization, whether we're talking about communication or it's often applied to software architecture, those two tend to mirror each other. So if you have an organization that has a lot of siloed departments, those organizations tend to develop applications that are very siloed and don't integrate well with one another.
Interesting. Can you give an example that most people would know of an example of an organization producing a product that is very segregated like that versus an organization that didn't? I mean, maybe this is too difficult of a question.
It's not a difficult question, but it's going to require a moment. You'll encounter this at restaurants sometimes. Restaurants actually are a great testbed for a lot of different examples. But if you have a situation where the front of the house, the servers and the maitre d' are not well connected with the back end, you can end up with situations where you get terrific food and terrible service or vice versa. You don't get an integrated experience throughout the cycle of the meal. In an organization where you have folks, where the chef will come out and ask how your dinner is, and the front of the house will go back and help expedite, you end up with a much more holistic dining experience as an end customer, and the care that is being taken at each step is clear. The maitre d' is going to be interested in learning more about you and what your tastes are so that they can help guide you in the menu so that the chef can do his best work for you. In a siloed organization, that information flow doesn't occur. So if the maitre d' is not really particularly caring where I sit in this restaurant and the fact that I may prefer booths to tables, for example, I might already have a somewhat biased opinion of my dining experience just by sitting down. Then if the server doesn't take the time to figure out what I'm interested in this experience, am I interested in having a casual dining experience, am I just in a hurry trying to catch a movie, whatnot, they will not give the kitchen the proper lead so that they know to expedite particular pieces of food or to slow things down so they can't pace the meal properly. They also won't be communicating my dining preferences to the chef either. And so the chef may not season things in a way that I would prefer because I didn't tell them that I really don't like salty food. So that's an example of how if you keep your developers and your QA and your database administrators apart, you can end up with odd situations in software. For example, you might have developers who are designing schemas that don't match well with the hardware that the database is being run on. They may not know this. If you're in a really siloed organization where these two groups have an antagonistic relationship and don't talk, developers will try to counter the performance problems that they're experiencing in the database by going through and either, I've seen really degenerate cases where they go away from trying to use the database as much as possible, where they might even go to something like a flat file structure in order to serve some kinds of data, as opposed to going to the DBAs and saying, hey, we've got a bunch of blobs that we really need to work with. How would you recommend us store those?
So you're saying flat files, are you referring to like Excel spreadsheets or what?
Of a flat file. Typically when you're talking about a flat file database structure, you're talking about maybe a directory with a bunch of files and folders in it.
Okay.
But yes, an Excel spreadsheet is an excellent example. You see this all the time too. You have a business group and you have an IT group and they don't have a good relationship. So you have these shadow IT operations where you have some guy who's really good with Excel and they end up writing an immense amount of business logic in this spreadsheet, business critical logic, I might add. And then that person either leaves or is on vacation or they run into a problem that they can't solve and they come back to IT and expect them to solve this problem. That only furthers a divide.
Yeah, yeah. When you refer to siloed organization, are matrix organizations and siloed organizations, is that one and the same, or is one an example of another, or how?
So typically matrix organizations is a management strategy where you've got lines of business and you've also got functional areas, and those are being treated as separate units. So for example, you might have IT, but you also have this line of business reporting, so that people typically report to two people. And when I'm talking about silos, I'm really only talking about one dimension of that. So
just functional. You're talking about functional
true. So in a matrix organization, it can be even worse because not only do you have these pressures of job functionality, but you also have pressures of lines of business.
So are matrix organizations are fundamentally anti-agile, or?
Now that's a... My MBA capstone professor would have an interesting time dissecting this particular question because it's matrix organizations are a particular study of his. I would tend to agree with him in that matrix organizations are often not the right answer, but they certainly do solve some challenges. There's a reason that matrix organizations evolved. I would argue that Agile is a better answer to many of the problems that matrix organizations are trying to solve.
So
I guess I would agree with you, Dan, in that they're not very compatible.
They're not very compatible, but when you're trying to develop an Agile organization, what may you be lacking in your structure if you do not have? What are going to be challenges for you because it is not matrixed? What are the weaknesses of a non-matrixed structure, if any?
So I parse that as the contrapositive, which is what are the advantages of a matrix organization?
Yeah, that was a discombobulated
if that's okay.
Way of asking.
Yeah, so...
It was a test question.
Yeah, good. I'm glad I parsed that correctly, I hope. What are some of the advantages of a matrix organization? Well, matrix organizations, in my experience, typically come up because of the way that budgets are usually aligned or assigned between groups. IT might have its own budget. Sales might have its own budget. Marketing might have its own budget and so forth. This is particularly true of IT, but it's also true of other functions as well. If I'm in, say, the sales organization, I might have some need of accounting. Maybe it's just simple expense report support, but I may need some accounting help. One way to achieve that goal would be to say, hey, let's have somebody from accounting who works with you in the sales organization. So now you have this accounting functionality with some reporting responsibility to sales. What this does is it gives you some guaranteed resources. You get some bandwidth for working on your sales-related problems. The downside is that this poor person who is stuck between sales and accounting has to consider both the needs of both sales and accounting whenever they're given tasks.
So having some kind of a more centralized budgeting would be a solution to eliminate – I'm feeding you the question here.
No, it's okay.
Would it be some way of eliminating – you know, having aggregate budgets as opposed to disparate or segregated budgets, would that eliminate cross purposes in the organization? Competing purposes, I guess. Competing
goals. Yes and no. So the trade-off here, of course, is complexity. When you get to an organization that's large, I mean, I work for a 75,000-person organization, an aggregated budget could be very difficult to align thousands and thousands of people to try to make sure that everybody's particular needs are being met, especially in a geographically diverse organization like SAP.
Right.
So it simply
this is a big, this is a tough yes, problem that lots of people are scratching their heads over.
It is. Simply combining budgets wouldn't be the answer. But all I'm saying is that I've noticed that when money is a very tightly controlled resource in most companies, and some of these more avant-garde organizational styles that we've been talking about during this conversation start to blur those lines. But when you're controlling money tightly, that drives behavior. So to get back to the whole agile thing, right? If you want to drive behavior, then you need to get the organization to support that behavior. If you want your teams to be making decisions for you, then you need to enable those teams to fulfill the consequences of the decisions that they're making.
I'm not sure
I have an idea for a great product on my team.
Okay.
Unless I get some sanction from the person who's paying my paycheck not to work on the thing that I've been assigned and to push that idea that I have, because I see great benefit in it. If I can convince you that that might be the case, then you might be willing to fund me. But you control my access to food, water, and shelter, right? So
right.
If I don't have control of that, then I'm beholden to the person who controls the money. If you instead give teams...
Or the people who signed your paycheck.
Oh, sure. Exactly. If you give teams a budget to explore this kind of thing and you give them some opportunities for entrepreneurship, for example, or you give them innovation days... However you want to term that, if you give them some license in order to develop these products, you'll find that teams will be much more willing to explore these ideas and drive new innovation. And by the way, that will also fuel their fire for developing the core of their job too, because they'll discover something that worked really well over here in this test project that they want to apply back to their main project.
This is very interesting, and I wish at some level I wish we had spoken before I spoke with Jesse, because now I'm learning something from you that in the discussion with him, which was a very attractive, fascinating idea that he was telling me. I don't know how familiar you are with Radley software, but they have this one value called creating your own reality.
Okay.
And so the idea is, you know, along with work-life balance and the typical, some of the more typical values an organization, a more progressive organization might have, they have this thing called creating your own reality,
sure,
which fits into this whole idea. You see a need, if it aligns with the values of the organization, if it supports some of the larger initiatives, and you see this need, you say, I would like to do this. And all of a sudden, people in a group will support you in this and say, we see that this aligns with our values. Mm-hmm. It will help us, help you do your job better, to help other people do their job better. How do we help you? Now, there was no discussion. I wasn't able to do a follow-up question with Jesse and ask him, where does the budget for this new initiative come from?
Interesting question. So...
If one has this sort of structure,
so
an agile structure.
Yeah, so if you have the structure and you're thinking about this in terms of business, one way that you could look at it would be a simple accounting. So every year when you're done with your accounting, you're going to take a look at something like an income statement, and you have hopefully gotten some positive net income from all your endeavors. What do you do with that money? You have two options from an accounting perspective. You're either going to pay out dividends to owners or shareholders, or you're going to reinvest in your business. I would argue that the money for the kind of projects that Jesse was talking about comes from that reinvestment. you make a conscious decision to invest in the growth, the creative growth of your people in this particular case.
And your organization. I mean,
it's
a two-sided thing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He gave an example where he was in a meeting where they were doing a deep dive with the sales team. Mm-hmm. And some of the junior salespeople were on the team were not that familiar with the culture of CA Technologies or Rally, nor that familiar with Agile. But they did a retrospective and they asked, what would your nirvana be? What would your dream scenario be? And these two new hires or recent hires said, well, it'd be really great when some of our senior salespeople are out in the field or our account managers are out in the field, that if we're queried on something, we would have the capability in-house where we could present to a potential client, even though, you know, some of our top senior presenters or salespeople are out in the field, that we could kind of provide some service to potential clients that come our way. And people said, that's a great idea, and wanted to help them, guide them, so that they could discover for themselves how to do this. And this sort of leads into your Montessori type
exactly.
of education.
It sure does,
it?
Yes. That's exactly the method that I would use, whether you want to call it kind of a Montessori method of teaching them how to do this kind of sales contact, or whether you want to think of it as a lean experiment of let's build up this capability in our junior salespeople.
Personal growth,
different
I guess
lenses.
It's the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all just different lenses on the same concept.
It's interesting. I mean, this comes down to, I mean, we're talking about a certain idea, sort of a Montessori lens, an agile lens, a personal growth lens. And we're talking about it in some ways that it's not common. So how have we been operating? I mean, I'm being partly stupid here.
No,
that's okay. That's my method.
No, it's
that's my exploratory method.
It's a very powerful method. I use it myself.
Why are these seemingly avant-garde or radical ideas? What have we been doing, I guess, is another way of saying it.
So you could argue that the Industrial Revolution brought upon us this idea of a mechanism to be controlled. If you take a look at the 19th century, that was the worldview that they had, was that nature is something to be tamed, and if you have perfect order, you will achieve perfect efficiency. And we've come to find out maybe even if you I'm putting my mathematics hat on right now, but if you start thinking about things like chaos theory, which came about in the 90s, mm-hmm. we started understanding that a lot of the processes that we hadn't been able to fully understand were due to the fact that they aren't perfectly ordered systems.
Like the butterfly, this nonlinear systems, Lyapunov equation and the butterfly effect and all this kind of stuff, is it?
Yeah, the butterfly effect is probably the one that's most familiar to listeners. But yes, this idea that uncontrolled inputs, you can have great output.
That's variation, I guess.
Sure.
Right? Great variation in output. Is it?
Well, you could take a look at it. When you say variation in output, I start thinking about evolution. That's another manifestation of the same idea.
Okay.
That you go through a number of different paths, and the strongest survive, in a sense. Or at least the more.
And this even comes down to ideation, right? You have you have an event, a brainstorming event. You diverge a bunch of ideas. Then you go through the groan zone. You explore some of these ideas,
sure,
and then you pick the optimal. You converge on a particular optimal solution.
Exactly. Yes. Yes, we are talking about that divergence, convergence, kind of design thinking. Mentality too. Those are all just different ways.
But you're talking
of expressing
about evolutionary.
I'm talking
process.
About different manifestations of the same idea. Because you were asking, why does this seem so revolutionary? It's really not, but we're discovering the limits of the previous paradigm that we had, which was this very structured, ordered workplace that had been created.
Right. You're right. None of these ideas are new. Somehow from what, the 1840s or whatever, when the farmers were brought to work in the textile mills in New England till now, we've been operating on a particularly strange – well, it essentially was economic feudalism, I guess, at some level.
In some ways. You have these machines that can do work very efficiently, but they required human operators. And the best way to get consistent output in that environment would be to do something like an assembly line, teach everybody to do things exactly the same way. Because the big problem that they were trying to solve was, well, before that world, if I wanted to have a gun or a plow made, I would end up going to a blacksmith. And hopefully it would be to the specifications that I wanted. Then guns are a great example of this, actually. You have a gun, and then you have to start making bullets, and bullets have to be within very tight tolerance for them to work well in these guns. So you would often end up throwing away or remelting a bunch of slag in order to get what you needed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first applications of this industrial machine that we're talking about was ammunition, and that revolutionized warfare.
So as we move to agile, we won't have any more bullets. We can it'll be the end of warfare.
Wow,
huh?
That's an interesting thought. What I do hope would
an
happen,
ill thought. Well, I'm just provoking.
No, that's okay. So what I would hope that we would achieve with agile would be some more global consciousness and being willing to be more tolerant of people's individual styles of working and their differences, and start to come together as a species. That's what I would hope.
That's great, but one of the other benefits, I definitely want to go there, but my point of bringing up that point was that perhaps if we move to – my understanding – I think you were touching on it. I had read somewhere as well that the purpose of the industrial organization, this pyramid structure with a rigid hierarchy, its main purpose was to limit variability.
Well, sure, and – collaterally, injuries on the job, a bunch of very positive effects too.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't work so well for the kind of work that's prevalent today, which is knowledge work.
True. It's not very human. It doesn't treat workers in a very human way.
Well, and knowledge work itself is a creative endeavor. You can't mandate you're going to have a breakthrough today.
Yeah. You must be creative or I'm going to whip you.
You could try, right? But it doesn't work.
Yeah, fear. High levels of fear and stress do not a creative person make.
Instead, you are better off creating an environment that has an optimum level of stimulus with some new ideas, with some structure, so that you can apply those ideas and develop something new. So a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about today, Dan, is really a balance between some competing needs. You need the capability to be creative and come up with new ideas and new ways of thinking about problems, but you also need some infrastructure in order to realize those ideas.
Right.
A salon doesn't produce any good product. You're just sitting around and having a good time over a beer,
and
right?
Pontificating.
Yes.
Great brainstorming.
You have to be able to realize those ideas, and often you need some sort of I'll just use the term industrial complex in order to create that idea.
Right.
What this whole conversation has been about is where is the dial between those two extremes?
This completes episode 2 of a 3-part conversation with Chuck Durfee. You can connect with Chuck Durfee on LinkedIn, follow him on Twitter at Chuck Durfee, and read his latest blog post at neontapir.github.io. That's N-E-O-N. TAPIR. He would be happy to receive your questions and comments at neontapir@gmail.com. You will, however, have to wait until the publishing of episode 3 to learn what a neon tapir is. However, if you really must know now, you could either email him or view his blog. The logo depicts a neon tapir. If you wish to learn more about Agile Denver, visit agiledenver.org. You can connect with the organization on LinkedIn and follow Agile Denver on Twitter at Agile Denver. To learn about future meetings, search for Agile Denver on meetup.com at meetup.com/Agile Denver. In the upcoming part of the conversation with Chuck Durfee, we cover his MBA studies, leadership styles, agile and ethics, power distribution in agile enterprises, political correctness, cargo cult agile, the issues with how millennials were raised, the creative process, how agile is changing the workplace, and the problems with matrix management. Stay tuned for these upcoming episodes. In part 4 of my discussion with Erica Lenz, Scrum Master and former evolutionary biologist, we chatted about what makes you unique, how a non-technical person adds value on technical teams, dancing, floor craft, and kinesthetic intelligence. The second millennial call was great fun. With 4 millennials, including one in India and my co-host Gert Penna in Belgium, we explored what the next generation finds attractive and healthy in workplace cultures and organizations. Recently, I was very fortunate to have interviewed John Spence, who is recognized as one of the top 100 business thought leaders and as one of the top 500 leadership development experts in the world. He is an international keynote speaker and management consultant and has written 5 books on business and life success. As some of you may have already noticed, Agile and Beyond is currently under construction. Once it goes live in several days, please visit and subscribe to the Agile and Beyond newsletter. Thank you. You've been listening to Agile and Beyond. Visit agileandbeyond.co and subscribe on iTunes. Until next time, keep evolving.